Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The Cows, Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Sunday, December 3rd, 2017. So I have been told we should be here on Tuesday, December 5th, next broadcast, the AFIA Center. You can look online at their website, the AFIA Center. .org. They have great resources, nonprofit organization, great resources specifically targeting black mothers who are in pregnancy, expecting black mothers, again addressing the high maternal mortality rates, and offering resources so that they can be healthy all the way through the birthing process and then rear healthy children. That'll be this coming Tuesday, normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward to that. I know we had questions. I know we have a lot of parents out there and maybe even some parents soon to be. So that'll be Tuesday. Looking forward to the broadcast. Folks, make suggestions for guests, people that we can have on the broadcast. Try to accommodate as best I can. One of our listeners recommended our guest for the broadcast today. They recommended one of his earlier books, a prolific writer, the book that they wanted to talk about, The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. Outstanding text. I think even the CIA worked to suppress publication of the text, which we might see if we can get a quick footnote. But since he's written so many different books, he wanted to talk about his latest publication, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. He does include some of his research on the heroin trade in the book, but this also is a very interesting read, and I know some of our listeners, actually quite a few of our listeners, were interested in this topic, and we're looking forward to hearing his commentary on the program. He is the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin. Real pleasure to have him on the program. Joining us live, our guest, Professor Alfred W. McCoy. Professor McCoy, you're with us?
Yes, I am, Gus. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for visiting with us this Sunday evening. Just for our listeners, I'm sure for some folks, this is their first time hearing from you. Just anything briefly that you would like to share that you think would be important for folks to know who you are and the work that you do?
Oh, sure. I'm a history professor. I've taught at the University of Wisconsin for nearly 30 years. I teach courses on U.S. foreign policy. I also teach graduate courses on Southeast Asia, which is my major area of expertise. And I work in particular on the Philippines, which in many ways is a nice area to work on if you're studying U.S. foreign policy, because since the United States emerged as a global power in 1898, now nearly 120 years ago, one of its closest, most constant objects of that power is the Philippines. And in every successive stage of the U.S. rise to global power, and indeed its ongoing process of decline, it's all the outlines, the nature of that power is oftentimes most sharply revealed, most clearly revealed in the Philippines. So I've also worked on the covert dimension of U.S. global power. That's to say, CIA operations, specifically alliances with drug lords, whether in Afghanistan, the Golden Triangle, Southeast Asia, or Central America. I've also worked on issues of torture. I did a couple, actually did three books on that subject. And I've also studied the U.S. use of global surveillance as a means of amplifying American power worldwide. So that's kind of what I do.
Outstanding. I think most, if not all, of those themes come up in The Shadows of the American Century. We'll try and highlight those as we can today. For folks who have not seen you, are you a white man, Professor McCoy?
Yeah, I'm white. I'm white.
Okay.
This Irish and German descent.
Okay. But you are a white man, yes?
Yes.
Okay. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I have concluded that we are in a global system, empire, if you will, of white supremacy racism. I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use those terms as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
It depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about the situation in the United States, there's clearly elements of it that are powerfully accurate. On a global scale, the Harvard historian Niall Ferguson counted something like 70 empires in world history. Only a few of those have been predominantly white. And indeed, the transition that I've been talking about in my book and writing and speaking about, from U.S. global hegemony to a challenge from China, would, of course, in your paradigm, markedly change the color and the character of that empire. So empire is a system of asymmetric power, of dominion and exploitation that doesn't require race to operate. In the modern world, sure, particularly after 1885, when the Europeans carved up Africa, and even before that, during the transatlantic slave trade, yes, race was very much a part of empire, indeed.
Well, hang on a second, really, Professor McCoy. One of the things that I have noted frequently in discussions on racism, particularly when I've been talking to white people, a lot of times I'll ask a question and they will kind of veer away from the question, or it'll sound like they're speaking to it, but they're not really answering it. If you could, just because I'm not really sure I got an answer to my question yet, and it sounds like you're kind of veering away even from what I asked. My question specifically, do you think global system of white supremacy racism, the definition that I outlined, do you think that that definition is accurate? Do you think that such a system exists?
Now?
Yes, sir.
Exists?
Yes, sir.
It existed for a particular period of time. In the history of empires, which stretched back 3,000 years, there's a period of maybe two centuries in which the dominant empires were white European, dominant over people in Africa and Asia. That's a system that's disappearing with the rise of China. So it's an accurate description for a particular period in the history of empires, but 200 years in 3,000 years of history means it's somewhat exceptional.
Okay. Even with that, I'm still not sure that I got an answer to the question. And I mean, that's just one thing that I really point out. That's super important. If you don't agree, if you don't think the definition is accurate, that's fine. But it doesn't seem that I'm getting a clear yes, you think such a system exists, or no, you don't think it exists, or do you think the definition is accurate? Is that possible to just get yes, that your definition is accurate, or no, it's not? And then you can add whatever caveats if you feel the need necessary, if you want to explain your answer.
No, it's not accurate now, but okay. during the period of what we call high imperialism, from the 1850s to the 1950s, it was a powerfully accurate. It was very accurate, but that's just one moment in the history of empires that came and has faded, and with the rise of China, will be fading even faster.
Okay. Grand. At moving forward, it would be great. It's so much more efficient because you just said no, you don't think it exists right now. If we could just get that at the beginning, it would save so much time. If you don't agree, if we have a difference of opinion, that's fine. We're also trying to sit at the grown-up table here. We just had Thanksgiving, they said. If you don't agree, that's fine. Just give us the answer and, you know, you can add your explanation. No problem. Moving forward with, actually, before I even get to In the Shadows of the American Century, if you will grant me one favor, your earlier work on CIA complicity with the heroin trade, it's accurate the CIA attempted to suppress publication of that text?
Oh, yes. The number two man in the CIA covert operations, a man named Cord Meyer Jr., walked into the offices of my publisher, HarperCollins, then known as Harper & Row, and spoke with the president emeritus of the corporation, an old family friend. They were both on the social register of New York's finest families, the aristocratic New York 400. And Mr. Cord Meyer Jr. denounced my book as a threat to national security and asked if HarperCollins couldn't simply suppress the book in order to stop the damage to national security. And fortunately, I knew Seymour Hersh, very famous investigative reporter who was then working for the New York Times. And so, although the publisher gave me no choice, they turned the manuscript over to the CIA. I was able to call Seymour Hersh, and the same day a courier arrived from the CIA to pick up a copy of the manuscript. Hersh rolled into the offices of the publisher and began interviewing people and put the CIA's attempt to suppress the book on page one of the New York Times. And the media counterattack basically blocked the agency from quietly suppressing the book. But their harassment didn't stop there. They still kept coming after me.
Wow. And what sort of things did you experience, this harassment?
Let's see. FBI tapped my phone. I had a poverty-level income. As a graduate student, I got a full IRS tax audit. Representatives from the U.S. Department of Education, which was then Health Education Welfare, came from Washington, Yale University, went through my graduate file to see if they had any grounds for charging me of fraud or something like that. In Southeast Asia, I had hiked into a Hmong highland village, an opium-growing village. I'd done extensive interviews in that village with farmers about their growing the opium, and they described to me quite consistently that when they were done harvesting the crop, they took it down to a helicopter landing strip where aircraft belonging to the CIA's proprietary airline, Air America, picked up their opium. Well, that village headman, who had assisted me with my inquiries, when the CIA was harassing in the United States, a helicopter landed in his village, picked him up, and took him to an interview with an American CIA operative who made it very clear that he had to lie and deny everything he had told me about the traffic, which he did.
There were other things that happened. For example, a guy I hadn't seen in 4 years, a college classmate who'd gone to work in military intelligence. I was at the Yale University co-op bookstore, and suddenly he popped up at my side, ready to resume our relationship. It just was too coincidental. It was clear it was a setup. They went for me. They went for me as hard as they could.
Fascinating. I guess challenging or revealing info about the CIA can be dangerous. I guess to kind of transition.
Okay. What was interesting about it was the one thing I hadn't realized, okay? You know, mind you, you know, we all have simple lives and not many points of pressure. But this was during the Cold War, an anomaly free society. A U.S. intelligence agency who's charged exclusively with operating outside the borders of the United States, okay? They're not internal security, that's the FBI. The CIA was able to tap, you know, arrange taps on my phone, audit my income taxes, pressure my publisher, mobilize my friends, attack my position in the university. Oh, and by the way, the same week that my book was given a favorable review on the front page of the New York Times Sunday Book Review, I received a notice of a threatened expulsion from Yale University for non-completion of my graduate requirements. In other words, in the thin tapestry of the life of a graduate student, the CIA was able to tug at every single thread as effectively as the secret police in any authoritarian state. Mm. Their penetration of American society during that period was extraordinary.
Right on. Just make sure I remind our listeners, the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Washington, you have managed to do all right, Wisconsin. Professor McCoy.
Wisconsin, Gus.
Did I say Wisconsin or Washington?
You said Washington.
Sorry. That's where I am, Washington State.
I know. UW versus, we say UW, you guys say UW. Yes, I know.
Right on. University of Wisconsin. To transition, I wanted to get to In the Shadows of American Century, you talk about the heroin trade in Southeast Asia. And even at the beginning of the broadcast today, you said that you can see the contours of American empire, I think most acutely, looking at the relationship with Southeast Asia. I guess, could you give more example or could you explain a bit?
Well, sure. If we take the heroin trade, which you mentioned, during the Vietnam War, the CIA mobilized an army of 30,000 Hmong hill tribe guerrillas fighting in the extraordinarily rugged and remote mountains of northern Laos. Now, U.S. forces couldn't fight there because 10 years before the Vietnam War began, Moscow and Washington agreed to the neutralization of Laos, and that prevented the U.S. from committing any conventional forces. Yet they still needed to be involved. So the U.S. Air Force unleashed the largest bombing campaign in the history of warfare. They dropped 2,100,000 tons of bombs on tiny, landlocked Laos. That's the same tonnage that the U.S. dropped on Germany and Japan in the whole of World War II. And they mobilized this secret army. Now, the Hmong hill tribe villagers lived atop the ridges and the mountaintops scattered across northern Laos. And their agricultural economy essentially involved two products. One, rice, carbohydrate for subsistence, and two, opium for cash. And in order to recruit 30,000 Hmong males from a tribal population of perhaps 250,000, the CIA had to provide financial support in order to keep those villages going, because this was a 15-year war. And the casualties were enormously high. So the CIA, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, provided rice, and they also turned a blind eye and allowed the Hmong to ship their opium from these scattered hilltop villages to the major opium markets inside the country. When the opium got down to the lowlands, the commander-in-chief of the Royal Laotian Army, a guy named General Uyên, whose military budget was provided about 99% of it came from the United States, maybe even virtually 100%. General Uyên ran the world's largest heroin lab, producing about 100 kilos of powdery white number 4 heroin a month for American GIs fighting in South Vietnam. The U.S. Embassy, when I asked them whether General Uyên had any involvement in the drug trade, they denied it, and when I interviewed General Uyên, I don't know why, but he opened his ledger on his opium accounts for me and let me copy notations of his various drug transactions. He was quite open about his drug dealing. But the embassy denied and covered up for him. In effect, the U.S. military and diplomatic establishment in Laos turned a blind eye while the tribes produced the opium. Overseas Chinese criminal chemists refined it into heroin. The military protected, organized, and exported the drugs, and they were sent to South Vietnam, where in 1971, according to a later White House survey, a full third of the U.S. Army fighting in South Vietnam in 1971 were heroin addicts. And it revealed, I think, the dynamics of the U.S. exercise of global power, that one of the distinct dimensions that separates the American hegemony from previous world empires was the covert dimension. That the United States, instead of having viceroys in ostrich-plumed hats and district officers in khaki shorts and formally colonized territories, they were dealing with sovereign states, which supposedly had national sovereignty. And so in order to resolve the contradiction between a world order of nearly 200 sovereign states and asymmetric power, U.S. hegemony, U.S. overweening global power, the United States intervened covertly. And it was that covert dimension of U.S. global power that I first saw in Southeast Asia.
Wow. Context of white supremacy, again, Professor Alfred W. McCoy. For listeners, I would just rephrase that. My viewpoint would be that that is an exercise of white supremacy, white people, U.S. state officials coming in, exercising dominion over these non-white people and what they're going to grow, what their crops are going to be, and then using them in this illicit drug trade. That would be the way I would analyze the situation, and just a refined aspect of racism, white supremacy, where it appears that this is a quote unquote sovereign nation, but white power is still being exercised. Absolutely. One thing I did want to ask, and again, this is from In the Shadows of the American Century. You talk about the decline that this is, you know, that is an era that was and is in decline now. You talk about that decline being saying that it's being challenged by what you term it's the Eurasian landmass, and that in conjunction with Africa merging into this world island that's going to challenge or replace what we've been talking about, what you're calling the U.S. empire. Can you just give our listeners some detail about what you mean when you talk about this Eurasian mass and how that's going to challenge the U.S. empire?
Sure. You know, a little over 100 years ago, back in January 1904, the head of the London School of Economics, a geographer named Sir Halford Mackinder, gave a lecture at the Royal Geographical Society in London, in which he titled his lecture, The Geographical Pivot of History. And he argued that in the past, for the past four or five centuries, Europe had dominated Asia because they had captured the sea lanes and were able to move cost-effective transport, agile naval movement around the Eurasian landmass, and the seamen dominated the landsmen of Europe and Asia. He said now the world was changing. What he was referring to was that in 1904, when he was speaking, the Trans-Siberian Railway was crawling slowly from Moscow for 5,000 miles across the Eurasian landmass all the way to Vladivostok on the Pacific, and for the first time there would be a transport infrastructure that would turn these nominally separate continents, Europe and Asia, which are actually a single landmass, the only continent that's one landmass divided into two. And it was only that vast, empty center of Eurasia that kept Europe and Asia apart. And now Sir Halford Mackinder said that the technology was changing this. Hello?
Oh, yes, sir. We can hear you.
Technology was changing this, and that Eurasia was unifying by technology. And when this happened, this would become the site of a new empire of the world. Now, of course, a lot of events intervened between 1904 and the present. The World War I, World War II, the Cold War, which dropped the Iron Curtain right down the middle of the Eurasian landmass, separating it into two blocks, communist and non-communist, or democratic or authoritarian, depending on whatever your divider might be. And it's only been since the end of the Cold War that Sir Halford's initial observation has been possible. And what's happened is in the past 10 years, China has invested $1 trillion from its burgeoning world trade to lay down a massive infrastructure of railroads, oil pipelines and gas pipelines, that when it's done, there will be a unified infrastructure of roads, railroads, and pipelines stretching from the Atlantic for 6,000 miles all the way across Eurasia to the Pacific, with China at the epicenter of this new system, this new global infrastructure. And that's happening very, very quickly. President Xi Jinping, last October in the Chinese Communist Party Congress, enshrined this principle into the Chinese Constitution under Xi Jinping thought. And this, what they call the One Belt Road, One Belt, One Road strategy, is now China's official state policy. The other thing that China's done is that China's begun to challenge quite directly U.S. dominion over the world island. About 10 years ago, another British academic, an Oxford professor named John Darwin, did a survey called After Tamerlane of 1,000 years of the struggle of empires on the Eurasian landmass. And Professor Darwin said in his study that the United States achieved extraordinary power after World War II, becoming the most powerful empire in history because it was the first power in the history of the world to control the axial ends of the Eurasian landmass. And what, Professor Darwin didn't elaborate, but what he meant when you think about those potent words was that after World War II, the United States set up the NATO alliance in Western Europe. That's one axial end of the Eurasian landmass. And then off on the other side of that landmass, it signed four mutual defense treaties with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia. And then throughout the Cold War, the United States laid down, you might call, circles of steel, bands of steel, between these two axial ends, arraying a massive military armada to dominate the Eurasian landmass that included, first of all, mutual defense treaties, NATO and the like, second of all, hundreds of military bases, 1,000 fighter aircraft, 1,000 ballistic missiles, and then three massive Navy fleets, the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean, the 5th Fleet in the Persian Gulf, and the 7th Fleet in the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific Ocean. And now China is, first of all, laying down an infrastructure that in a certain sense renders the U.S. system redundant. But moreover, China is developing the strategic capability of slicing through those arcs of steel that the United States has maintained around the world island since the end of World War II. China is building 7 military bases in the South China Sea. And it's got it's laying down a $46 billion transportation corridor from Western China through Pakistan down to the Arabian Sea, and China has invested $200 billion in transforming a sleepy fishing village on the Arabian Sea inside Pakistan, a place called Gwadar, into a very modern port. Also, China just last year rented a naval facility in Djibouti. So China now has 2 naval bases on the Arabian Sea, just hours away from the mouth of the Persian Gulf. So China is, by virtue of this two-part strategy, one, laying down this $1 trillion infrastructure across the Eurasian landmass, and second, massive military buildup with bases challenging and slicing through those arcs of steel that Washington has maintained around the Eurasian continent. China is systematically challenging U.S. global power.
In your book, one of the ways that you write about China also challenging U.S. empire is massive investment in supercomputers to rival, if not surpass, what the United States has. I wanted you to talk about, and going back to your earlier premise that you can look at the rise and fall of U.S. power, you can look at it most acutely and how it is demonstrated in Southeast Asia. You talk about the critical importance of having surveillance if you're going to maintain a system of domination, an empire. And you talk about how United States, the history of United States or the development of the United States surveillance apparatus, that you can look at their practices in colonizing the Philippines. I guess, could you explain some of that for our listeners?
Sure. You've got a two-part question. Mm. First part is China's rising technological edge, and second of all, the U.S. reliance upon technology, particularly surveillance technology, as a part of its global apparatus. So let me see if I can tie those two things together. First of all, let's sort of start at the beginning with the U.S. use of technology. The United States, during its pacification of the Philippines after 1898, faced a conventional Philippine Revolutionary Army, which it fought in main force battles and very quickly smashed. The Filipinos retreated into guerrilla warfare, at which they were quite effective. And the U.S. suddenly found itself, you know, with, as one American officer put it, overwhelming force, but no idea of where and how to apply that force. In other words, they lacked intelligence. And so the U.S. Army set up the first field intelligence unit in its history, something they called the Division of Military Information. And they used that massive amount of information to begin the pacification of the country. One of the things they did was they decided that they would build an index of every politically active Filipino, height, weight, physical appearance, personal connections, wealth, landholding, systematic sort of surveillance index. And then once the guerrilla resistance was broken, the United States still faced the difficult problem of breaking the Filipino aspiration for independence, at least containing it under U.S. colonial rule. And so the United States built a very effective surveillance apparatus, both the Manila Metropolitan Police and an organization called the Philippines Constabulary. And essentially what they did was they hired hundreds of Filipino spies. They monitored all public space, newspapers, public rallies, and the like, and they collected systematic information on every politically active Filipino. And they developed, basically, through this surveillance, incriminating information, which is always about two things, sex and money. Those Filipinos who cooperated with the United States found that the information was suppressed. But those that insisted on resisting would find that the information would be leaked into the public arena, discrediting them. For example, the founder and the commander of the Philippine Constabulary was a West Point graduate and a U.S. Army officer named Henry Allen. Henry Allen had a very distinguished military career after he, you know, resigned his command of the Constabulary and went back to the United States. He became a division commander during World War I. He was the chief of the U.S. occupation of the Rhineland after the end of World War I. And when he retired to the United States near Washington, D.C., he was briefly considered for the 1928 Democratic Party vice presidential nomination. In short, a very prominent individual. Now, through that journey that I just described from the Philippines to retirement near Washington, General Allen, who had tens of thousands of intelligence reports crossing his desk, he kept just one of them in his personal files, which I found in Washington, D.C., and it was titled The Strange History of MQ, talking about how this Filipino politician had relationships with his two half-sisters, one of which produced an abortion, and they had the location of where the fetus was allegedly buried, and the other of whom would become his wife. Well, MQ was Manuel Quezon. The capital of the Philippines is Quezon City. He was a very powerful politician. General Allen kept this report on Quezon, this very damning report about Quezon's philandering, his murders, and all the rest, lots of scandalous information, in his private files as insurance, just in case Quezon ever crossed him. And that's the way the system operated. Now, the man who was head of the Division of Military Information in the Philippines was a medical doctor named Ralph Van Diemen. He headed that organization there. As I said, this was the first experience of the U.S. Army in intelligence. And when World War I broke out, the U.S. Army was the only army on either side of the battle lines in Europe that didn't have an intelligence service. And so Ralph Van Diemen, drawing upon his Filipino colonial experience, became founder of the Military Information Division. He's known now as the father of U.S. military intelligence. And he imported all of those surveillance techniques from the colonial Philippines into the United States. And he worked in collaboration with the FBI in mounting a massive operation of surveillance during World War I. The Division of Military Information and the FBI had about 350,000 badge-carrying civilian vigilantes spying on their fellow Americans during World War I. And then when the war was over, the FBI took over that operation, and there's a clear continuity in FBI surveillance operations running from the Philippines through World War I right up to the present. And when we look at, you know, Edward Snowden's revelations, the documents he leaked from the NSA back in 2013, one of the things that's really interesting is the head of the NSA, General Alexander, General Keith Alexander, is we find documents of him giving orders for the NSA to collect information about these sexual peccadilloes, the online, you know, pornography viewing, and the financial manipulations of suspected Islamic radicals wanting to use the same thing, sex and money, to discredit them and destroy their reputations. So it's that's the logic that explains, I think, why the NSA, you know, was surveilling very close American allies and leaders, you know, the president of Mexico, Angela Merkel, the chancellor of Germany, etc. You know, basically, you know, collecting incriminating information to encourage compliance with U.S. requisites for the exercise of global power. Now, China's challenge. China's mounting a cross-the-board challenge to U.S. global power.
Hold on one second. Like, I wanted to pause on the surveillance aspect 1 minute before you talk about their challenge to this, because you do include in the text, I think, related to the sexual deviance that you just talked about. This is reminiscent of J. Edgar Hoover with the FBI, his sexual deviant files that he had in the 60s. And you talked about the same sort of exercise to control people and make sure that you can just mention what you have in these files. You talked about the same thing with Dr. King and passing right around these files of his audio of his alleged philandering. And that stood out because we talked about that a few times on the program. One of our previous guests, John Patash, he's wrote a few books. His book, Drugs as a Weapon Against Us, a lot of similarities to your work on the heroin trade. But he also has done a lot of work on the FBI surveillance from the 1960s, particularly against black activists who were working against white supremacy racism. And he talks about the FBI surveillance of Dr. King and those allegations of his extramarital affairs and both while he was alive and after his assassination. And this even came up with the files that were recently released on JFK. They still had that information about Dr. King and his alleged affairs and what have you. I wanted to ask, since one of the tactics of this surveillance campaign, particularly from the 1960s with J. Edgar Hoover, his COINTELPRO activities, one of those tactics was to spread misinformation to discredit people. These allegations against Dr. King about his sexual impropriety, do you think it's logical to challenge the veracity of these reports, given that that's one of the stated goals of COINTELPRO, to deliberately put out false information to discredit individuals like Dr. King?
Well, one thing nobody's ever done is subjected the tapes. I mean, we've heard about the tapes. I don't know if they still exist, but it's easy to fabricate an audio tape. And you know, there's a technology for testing whether or not the voice is actually an individual's voice. It's not flawless. It's more accurate than a guess. So, you know, until somebody tests the tapes with audio technology and, you know, voice imaging, nobody can know for sure. Given that, you know, COINTELPRO did things like they tried to provoke killings between, I think, what's his name, Ron Karenga and of US and the Black Panther chapter in Los Angeles. They brought them, I think, to the point where there were killings. The FBI was unrestrained in its tactics. And I don't think there has never been a full and independent investigation of what COINTELPRO was up to. It's very possible that the violence of the 1970s was agent provocateur. And the FBI says that there were 2,600 illegal acts under COINTELPRO, but there has not been a substantive investigation of that period and those activities. We don't know how dark and dirty it got, because the whole thing is off the shelf. It's not done according to the chain of command, where officials give clear instructions to subordinates, and the subordinates are held accountable under whatever the operating rules are. It's all done privately. It's all done verbally. It's all done for non-attribution, on the basis of possible denial later on. So, you know, how far, how wild, how inventive some people might have gotten under COINTELPRO, we just don't know. But virtually just about anything is possible.
Mm.
I mean, what am I here in my little city? The most dramatic act under COINTELPRO, I mean, you know, as long as we're speculating, and this is speculative, was a thing called the Army Math Bombing. If you go to the University of Wisconsin Madison campus, there's a plaque up that marks this. And I think it was in August of 1970 that four anti-war activists drove a truck loaded with ammonium phosphate, I think it was, agriculture fertilizer, and lubricating oil, and they set off a fuse and they blew up a building and they killed a young PhD researcher who was working late, 4 o'clock in the morning, on his doctoral dissertation. And that was an incredible explosion that blew out windows as far as a mile away. It was kind of like the McVeigh bombing of the Oklahoma City federal building. And, you know, they caught three of the guys right away. Well, it took them some time, but they got them. The fourth guy, Leo Burt. Leo Burt is the longest-running fugitive in U.S. history. Leo Burt has not been caught. And, you know, Leo Burt is a curious character. He was a graduate of a Catholic high school near Philadelphia, Monsignor Bonner High School. He was an altar boy. He was profoundly conservative. He came to the University of Wisconsin, Madison, because he was a rower. He rowed crew. And right after the bombing, there was an AP, an Associated Press story, that hit the wires that said that Leo Burt had come to, you know, more or less, how did an altar boy become a mad bomber, okay? And the article, which came out just a couple of days right after the bombing, kind of like explaining this, said that Leo Burt had come to Wisconsin to row in the varsity crew, and when he got cut to the junior varsity, he became enraged, and this turned him into this mad bomber. Well, on the face of it, the story might have some sense, unless you know something about the sport of rowing, of crew. The nature of the teamwork is such that it is the most self-effacing sport ever. I mean, there is no individual in rowing. What boat you're in, whether you're first or second or
Professor
reserve,
McCoy, I want to hop in really quick just because there are some other aspects of the book that I want to touch on.
Let me just finish, okay? So, well, you know,
could you be brief in
some
ways?
That article reads to me like a cover story for a COINTELPRO penetration guy that did this massive bombing.
Mm.
Leo Burt is still a fugitive. There's a $150,000 reward for him from 1970.
Okay.
So, yeah, COINTELPRO did a lot of different things.
Yes, sir. You in Shadows of the American Century, the chapter Torture and the Eclipse of Empires, you write, From the perspective of informed opinion in Berlin, Beijing, Brasilia, Cairo, London, Mumbai, or Tokyo, America could not and cannot, now or in the future, simultaneously claim both moral leadership of the international community and the sovereign prerogative to torture at will in defiance of international law. Can you explain?
Sure. Torture was one of the aspects of U.S. covert operations during the Cold War. During the 1950s, the United States mounted a massive project in exploration of mind control. Right at the start of the Cold War, for a number of reasons, the United States became convinced that the Soviet study of the human mind had made a breakthrough, and the Soviets had learned how to program people to conduct acts against their will. So the U.S. decided that they had to develop the same capacity. And there was a conference in 1951 between British, Canadian, and American officials, including the CIA, in which they decided to launch a massive mind control project. And under this project, they tested, first of all, exotic things like hypnosis, electroshock, drugs like LSD, to see if they could make people speak involuntarily. And they found that basically none of the exotic techniques worked. But what they discovered through rather mundane behavioral science was that this conventional science held some of the answers. And in particular, they worked with a Canadian researcher who discovered sensory deprivation, that simply by asking student volunteers at McGill University to sit in a comfortable air-conditioned cubicle with goggles, gloves, and earmuffs, deprived of sensory stimulus, that they would first begin hallucinating as if they were on mescaline, and then they would suffer a psychological breakdown just with goggles, gloves, and earmuffs. And this sensory deprivation and this technique was used by the CIA throughout the Cold War. And when the War on Terror started in 2001, the CIA hired two former Air Force trainers. The United States not only used this technique offensively, but they also trained any American serviceman likely of capture into techniques to resist these techniques. And obviously, pilots were some of the most likely to be shot down and captured. Therefore, the Air Force had sort of anti-interrogation training. And they hired two psychologists who worked for the U.S. Air Force to retrofit these techniques and, again, apply them. And so you'll notice that when you look at the photographs of the first detainees that arrive at Guantanamo in 2001 and 2002, actually early 2002, they're outside kneeling for prayer, for Islamic prayer, and they're wearing goggles, gloves, and earmuffs, just like those used in the experiments back at McGill University in 1954. Now, these techniques were not always so benign. During the Vietnam War, for example, the CIA applied mass interrogation and torture to the task of breaking the Viet Cong infrastructure, the underground government of concealed operatives for the communist infrastructure in South Vietnam. And they tortured countless tens of thousands of people, and they killed 41,000 suspected Viet Cong through this project, Operation Phoenix. They applied it the same techniques in Central America during the 1970s and 1980s and various pacification operations there. And you know, at the end of the Cold War, there were revelations about both the torture in Vietnam and the torture training in Latin America. This led to the abolition of one of the USAID programs, a police training program. There were some congressional investigations, and then we thought that it went away, that it was over, that now that the Cold War was over. the world could finally abolish this incredibly cruel and inhumane practice. In the 1980s, the UN passed the Convention Against Torture. In 1994, under the Clinton administration, the U.S. finally ratified
Professor
that
McCoy,
convention.
Can I hit pause really quick?
Sure.
Okay. Just even the frame of reference and the use of the word torture, I want to ask a question to tie back into what you've just been giving, the history of torture being used in American empire and looking at the frames of reference. You are in Wisconsin?
That's correct.
Okay. You're familiar with Jeffrey Dahmer?
Sure, of course.
Is it accurate to say that Jeffrey Dahmer tortured his victims?
That I don't know. I'm sorry.
Wait a minute. You said you are familiar with Jeffrey Dahmer?
I read about him in the press, and I read about the finding of the body parts in his refrigerator and all the rest.
And I read
about how he was killed in a penitentiary by his fellow inmates.
Did you read about how he cannibalized his victims?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry. I didn't.
Wow. I do. That is amazing. I find it.
I knew he had body parts in his refrigerator.
Okay.
No.
I do find that amazing for you to be so informed. You've written all of these books and talk about global politics, and for something to literally happen right in your backyard to be that poorly informed in a case that got so much national attention, you don't feel qualified to say whether or not Jeffrey Dahmer tortured his mostly black victims. But, okay, no problem. Are you familiar with John Burge?
I'm sorry, with who?
John Burge, B-U-R-G-E.
Oh, let's hold on. No, I'm sorry. I'm afraid not.
Okay. He was a police officer in Chicago. He ended his tenure in disgrace. He ended up being convicted of some crimes, lying about what he did. But while he was the chief of the Chicago Police Department, he carried on a campaign of torture, and that's the word that they use in describing what he did. He carried on a campaign of torture for decades in Chicago, primarily targeting black people, including using shocks on their testicles and making them to confess to crimes that they didn't commit, choking people until they blacked out. They use the word torture, and in fact, they've issued reparations to certain Chicago citizens who were victims of John Burge's torture, and they've mandated that this be taught in the Chicago public schools. Are you familiar with enslavement of black people in this part of the world, the United States? You're aware that for a long period of time, years and years and years, black people were enslaved in this part of the world?
Of course.
Okay. Do you think it's accurate to describe that as torture?
Torture was part of the system. I mean, the whole system was torturous.
Okay, so that would be, yes, that would be accurate to say that that was torture, right?
Yes.
Okay, sure. Okay. Edward Baptist, for folks who are with
us.
Hang on one second, because this is important. The reason that I was injecting this, the question that I asked you was about the paragraph from your text, which to me, where you write, America could not and cannot now or in the future simultaneously claim both moral leadership of the international community and the sovereign prerogative to torture at will in the defiance of international law. And the reason that I asked you about Jeffrey Dahmer, who, in my view, it's accurate to say that he tortured, and I have a hard time believing that you don't know enough information to say whether or not Jeffrey Dahmer tortured his victims. But be that as it may, in my view, or the reason that I brought that up, it has been standard operating procedure for white people to torture black people throughout the history of what you call America or U.S. empire. That's been standard operating procedure every day. And it's not, you don't even use any examples. You have a whole chapter in your text about torture. None of the reference points are to black people. The whole history of lynching black people in the United States. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, of course. I mean,
does that constitute torture? Do you think it's accurate to describe lynching black people as torture?
I mean, torture often preceded the killing, but the killing would be deemed to be, under international law, an extrajudicial killing. and there would be the conditions of how the victim was treated prior to that. And most lynchings, I think, entailed torture prior to the lynching, but that's just a supposition on my part.
Wow. I guess I should not be surprised, but it just sounds like an unwillingness or a lack of comfort in pointing out to me what seemed like obvious illustrations of torture. I mean, we're talking about people that were frequently castrated, mutilated, made to suffer for hours before they were actually killed. And this is well documented. I'm very curious both on two points as to why none of these illustrations, even Jeffrey Dahmer, you're right, in Wisconsin, none of these examples are in a whole chapter about the history, use of terrorism in American empire. None of these are included in your examples. No illustrations. And in my view, there's no clearer example of how torture has been used throughout the history of what you call American empire, what I call the system of white supremacy, than the way that Black people have, and I would say continue to be treated. And that's not in your text at all. And even to the last sentence about the some sort of incompatibility with American morals or American moral values being incompatible with torture, I would just say, wow, look at the history of how Black people have been treated. It seems that to be very compatible with American empire or America's existence, torturing Black people. It seems to be an integral required activity. Is what I'm saying, is it logical? Does it make sense? Or do you not understand what I'm saying?
No, I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
We're talking about apples and oranges. You're talking about U.S. domestic
metaphor.
Policy. I'm talking about foreign policy. If I could just finish, Gus.
U.S. global empire, but go ahead.
Sorry, if you could, Gus, if I could just please finish my statement.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Torture, in the sense that I'm talking about it, is an act of state.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so what that chapter is talking about is the U.S. state practice. Okay, what you're talking about are domestic practices by within the society by social actors who sometimes are and sometimes aren't. In your examples, Jeffrey Dahmer was not an agent of the state. He was not an employee of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. He was just a deeply disturbed individual. Okay? The Chicago Police Department, yes, that was an act of not the federal government, but a state, actually a municipal government. But what I'm talking about are state activities. In this case, in the United States, the U.S. government, okay? You're talking about other issues.
Other issues? I think you just said that John Burge was a practitioner of the state. He was a member of the chief, not just some low-level officer. He was the chief, and I'm pretty sure.
Municipal employee.
I'm pretty sure I could have got.
You asked
for the same opportunity to speak. I would like the same opportunity to speak without being interrupted. I'm pretty sure it would not be difficult, especially since we've mentioned COINTELPRO, for me to go through and find if you need a state official, if you need a federal official, to go all the way through and pick out different examples where these individuals have exercised torture against Black people. It just, both in the text and in your responses today, both of them, it just seems you seem very unwilling, very uncomfortable, just acknowledging that torture of Black people has been an integral part of U.S. empire domestically and internationally for centuries, for the duration. It escapes me in the text. It escapes me in talking to you now. Could be that you're practicing racism, white supremacy. You seem to be suggesting, if I understand you correctly, that you just have a different focus. You're not focused on what's happened to Black people domestically. You're talking more about the global machinations of U.S. empire, specifically, you say, acutely looking at what's happened in Southeast Asia. So you're not as focused on Black people. To me, it just seems like that could have easily been included and would have bolstered what you're talking about in the text.
Jeffrey Dahmer wouldn't have bolstered what I was talking about in the text.
It doesn't have to be Jeffrey Dahmer. As I said, there are tons of illustrations. I just happen to pick him out because he's right there where you are. But
my book does reference the Chicago police thing.
Okay. No worries. Moving forward, you also talked about, make sure I get my, on 233, Should I get to my page here? On 233, you write a new global oligopoly might emerge between 2020 and 2030 with rising powers China, Russia, India, and Brazil collaborating with receding powers like Britain, Germany, Japan, and the United States to enforce an ad hoc global dominion akin to the loose alliance of European empires that ruled half of humanity circa 1900. In a darker dystopian version of this future world order, a coalition of transnational corporations, multilateral military forces like NATO, and an international financial leadership self-selected at Davos and Bilderberg might forge a supranational nexus to supersede any nation or empire. With denationalized corporations and elites ruling such a world from their secure urban enclaves, Geneva, London, Manhattan, Shanghai, or Sydney, the multitudes would be relegated to urban and rural wastelands. By 2030, there will be 662 cities worldwide with populations of over a million, including 41 megacities with more than 10 million inhabitants. By then, half of humanity will want for adequate water supplies, and over a third of the Earth's farmland will suffer degraded soils, threatening food security for many of the world's poor. You go on to describe really bleak conditions and talking about these megacities where you have people huddled up, and a lot of people, particularly in the global South, suffering. To me, it sounded like a lot of non-white people might be suffering, but I mean, it sounds like very bad times if there is a decline in U.S. empire, even bad times globally. Can you give some more detail?
Well, now first of all, I'm talking about the future,
mm-hmm.
and it's all hypothetical. You've canvassed several of the scenarios, the five major scenarios for the imperial transition beyond an era of untrammeled U.S. hegemony. That's the sort of dismal dystopian view of what can happen. Right now, if you project climate change forward, the desertification, aridification, much of the Middle East, Sub-Saharan Africa, maybe parts of the American Southwest, portions of Mexico, other areas of the globe, much of Australia, would become non-habitable. Temperatures beyond which most human beings can stand to work for much of the year. And, the implications of that are profound. The disruptions that would set off in the international order, not to mention the untold mass suffering of inadequate water and food. But I think one of the things we're likely to see are mass migrations. We saw, as a result of the Syrian war, the migration of a million people from Syria into Europe. And, for the past 2 years, we've been observing the political backlash, the rise of the right, much of it expressly fascist, in Europe in reaction to that migration from the Middle East. And so if you multiply that times, let's say, 200, within 30 or 40 years, there could be 200 million people on the march around the globe, fleeing these horrific conditions. It boggles the mind. I mean, to think about what could happen. Would the more well-watered, prosperous areas of the globe take in millions upon millions of people that were necessarily fleeing unsustainable ecosystems? I don't know. I don't think they will. I don't think they would. And then how do they keep them out? And what are the implications for the world in which we live? It's daunting. Nobody is speculating about this. Nobody's thinking about this. But it's a likely consequence if you put the global warming and the climate change, you go forward to certainly by 2040, there'll be signs of this. By the end of the century, it'll be very well advanced.
Do you think with these mass migrations, do you think, just asking a question I think is important, because what I've seen thus far with these massive migrations, like what you're talking about with Syria and folks coming from different parts of the continent and the Caribbean due to climate change and these storms, you talk about that as well, having more of these major storms that can, you know, disrupt entire nations and their ability to respond. Do you think it's going to be a lot of non-white people that are asking, you know, for help and looking to migrate and white people still being in positions to make decisions about whether or not they will be allowed status, sanctuary status?
Well, it's in the movement from Central America and the Caribbean to the United States, yes, that's going to be a racial dimension there. We've already seen, as a result of the recent hurricane in Puerto Rico, that there's something like 250,000 Puerto Ricans have already moved to the United States, which they can do, of course, quite legally. And so there's no, they just hop on planes and move. There's 250,000 people. There could be 1 million, 2 million that will eventually move to the United States. As desertification continues, much of Mexico, I think, would be unsustainable. There would be pressure northward to the United States, out of Caribbean islands. We've seen that from Haiti, but that's likely to continue. The logical place to move is to more temperate climate with better water. And so that means moving, you know, in this case, north and south. So, you know, in Europe, we already have not just the migration from Syria, but much of that migration, that million, is from sub-Saharan Africa, people crossing Africa to Libya, Morocco, trying to get into Europe either via Spain or Greece or Italy. And that's ongoing. That's likely to become much, much worse as East Africa, Sudan, Somalia become unsustainable ecologically. But that's then what you've got is you've got areas, for example, as the seas rise, Bangladesh, which is enormously densely populated, will become basically unsustainable for human habitation. So you're going to have Bengalis moving either into Burma or India. There'll be areas in Southeast Asia, Manila, Jakarta, Saigon. These are mega cities that will be 20 million inhabitants each. They'll become probably uninhabitable as the sea rises. And so that's going to be people moving with you know, Southeast Asians moving within the Southeast Asia region, upland. You know, so that it's going to be... There is an ethnic dimension to it between Africa and Europe and between the Caribbean and the United States, but elsewhere in the world, no. No, it's just the movement of peoples.
For folks, if you have a question for Professor McCoy, you can feel free to chime in 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I guess
now, the implications.
Go ahead.
The political implications of that, in terms of U.S. global power, in the midst of this turmoil, that's likely to proceed beginning from about 2040 onward for the rest of the century. First of all, nobody in Washington so far added up the cost of storm damage. We've already seen very heavy storm damage costs that are coming through Congress, billions of dollars for the repair of Houston. So far, not adequate funding for the repair of Puerto Rico. But this is going to persist. So the cost of cleanup, remediation, and then prevention, the building of massive sea gates at the mouths of Boston, New York, the Chesapeake Bay, every body of water that's protected, is going to be billions of dollars. When the Southwest starts a process of desertification and there's out-migration and damage, relocation costs, this is going to strain the fiscal resources of the United States. And one of the things that I've said elsewhere is that empire is roughly about a 5% proposition. In other words, maintaining an empire for an ascendant power means the discretionary allocation of about 5% of gross domestic product to maintaining or this very complex and very costly overseas apparatus. Well, when these domestic costs for remediation, resettlement, and prevention of climate change damage, when they began to strain the fiscal resources of the United States government, there'll come a point when we'll have to make a choice between our global military apparatus, which is central to U.S. global power, or dealing with the demands of a citizenry in the United States. And Britain faced the same choice back in the 1950s. They diverted funds away from the empire to social welfare costs. And so by the late 1950s, they simply couldn't maintain the costs of running their empire anymore. And that's, I think, climate change will be one of those forces, along with the aging of the U.S. population and the costs of sustaining a more graying population. Both of those things are going to mean that we simply don't have that discretionary imperial 5% anymore.
Hmm. What role do you think, because there's been also a lot of talk about specifically with white people, fertility rates not being high enough. I think the term that they used for the United States specifically, talking about the browning of America and whites not constituting as high a percentage of the population as they used to. Do you think that's going to factor into the alleged decline of U.S. empire?
No. If anything, that's one of the strengths of the United States as a global power. Having an ethnically diverse population drawn from all over the globe gives us people that have language and cultural skills. It means we're more our diplomats if they go to more diversified schools, if they have contact, which some do, some don't. It means that they're more agile culturally, more supple. We're a more open society. People come in and out. They visit us. The flow of tourists and travelers from around the globe into the United States, which has until recently been a hallmark of U.S. global power and some of our economic strength as well. If anything, the increasing diversity of American society would strengthen the United States. And as you put it, overcoming that demographic deficit. So also migration, which we're likely to tamp down under this current administration, and as long as the anti-migration movement continues, is in fact a one of the strengths of American economic growth. Immigrants come to this country usually without the burden of children or without the burden of elders to be maintained. So we immigrant gives you somebody who's been educated by another state at a cost to another state, not American society, who is tested and selected as being a very qualified worker, whether manual labor or a software engineer, by the ability to migrate and adapt to new culture as a more agile, adaptable, more productive human being. No, immigration is an enormous strength in this society has had for centuries. So the browning of America, no, it's just part of that ongoing diversity, just change. It's part of the health and dynamism of this country.
Hmm. Interesting. See if we can stop and nab a few callers along the way. Rob in Wisconsin, right in your neck of the woods. If you had a question for Professor Alfred W. McCoy, you should be with us. Rob in Wisconsin.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus, for the program this evening. And thanks to the guests for coming on. I am in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Home of Jeffrey Dahmer. Question with the opioid epidemic here in Milwaukee and around the nation. Do you have an analysis of the way white people are being treated when it comes to the opioid epidemic here in Milwaukee?
Not specifically Milwaukee, no, I'm sorry. I've been following the national debate on opioid abuse. One of the things that that marks a difference in this round of America's century-long experiment in drug prohibition is that for the first time since really the 1920s and 1930s, at least a substantial share of the abuse of the problem is among whites rather than African Americans or Mexicans, and so this gives this epidemic, this particular epidemic, if you will, an extraordinary political power that it hasn't had in the past. And that really changes the nature and character of the debate. The subtext of racism and blame that appeared back in the 1960s and 70s when heroin began spreading mainly, predominantly, but not exclusively, among African Americans and in inner city neighborhoods, that is not present in this debate. That's not a hallmark of this debate. It's cutting right across the country, rural as well as urban. Arguably, if you read the anecdotal evidence, and I haven't seen any breakdown so far, it's as much, if not more, white than it is African American. And that changes the political character of the debate.
Just a follow-up question. In my analysis here in Milwaukee, I see white people using heroin and black people selling it. Do you have any analysis of why that is?
If I had to guess, it's because whites, by anecdotal evidence, began their opioid abuse through the aggressive marketing of legal pharmaceutical drugs. And now we're beginning to tamp down. There has been imposition of controls. The doctors that were writing sheafs of prescriptions are being sanctioned. The government is putting pressure upon the pharmaceutical companies and the medical profession. The whole anti-pain movement that legitimated the mass prescription of just handing out opioids for any kind of post-surgical treatment, any kind of level of pain. You go in there and you see the pain chart 1 to 10, you say you got a lot of pain, doctor writes your prescription for pharmaceutical opioids, and you very quickly develop a dependency. And now what we're seeing is that if that's being cut off, those who are habituated addicts, if you will, are being forced to turn to the to the illegal networks to get their supply. And historically, those illegal networks have been in the inner city minority areas rather than in the white rural communities or in the suburbs. And this is, I think it's probably just a transitional phase until you get the construction of the development of a broader trafficking networks. The other thing that's going to happen, too, I think, is that there's going to be a proliferation of illegal heroin coming in from Afghanistan. Already across Canada, estimates are as high as 90% of illegal opioids, heroin, across Canada is coming from Afghanistan. Well, as the U.S. government under the Trump administration, conducts, basically puts pressure upon the legitimate pharmaceutical outlets and begins to cut off that supply, the addicts are going to have to turn to the street, and that'll mean more and more networks coming down from Canada or perhaps directly into the United States. We're going to see a reviving of criminal and illegal narcotics dealing in the United States. Ultimately, since 90% of the world's heroin comes from Afghanistan, it means that the U.S. operations in Afghanistan are going to have direct implications for what's going on in the United States. Our heroines are coming from Afghanistan.
May I ask one more question, Gus?
Sure.
You spoke about the doctors handing out the prescription and basically causing the addictions. Are you aware of the article that speaks of white people basically getting prescribed the drugs and black people not getting prescribed the drugs because black people are seen to not be in as much pain as white people. Are you aware of that article, sir?
No, I'm not. It's not surprising. You know, on the whole, you know, access to medical practitioners is, you know, according to socioeconomic background, and, you know, there'd be a disproportionate number of African Americans who wouldn't have regular access to medical practitioners. And it doesn't surprise me that that phenomenon would be occurring.
Thank you.
Appreciate that, Rob. In Wisconsin, person who called in, I believe you're on the VOPE line. If you dialed in on the VOPE line and you had a question for Professor McCoy, you should be with us.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, can you hear me clearly?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Hi. Thank you, Gus, and the guest. I wanted to ask Dr. McCoy, you mentioned that your focus is Southeast Asia.
Correct.
I'd like to know what the Southeast Asian ASEAN member states, what their engagement in Africa is, specifically Africa south of the Sahara, like with the ECOWAS or with the East African community member states, for example, what their economic or infrastructural development or engagement is with those countries, the ASEAN community.
Yeah, so far, the major relationship between Southeast Asia and that part of the world, East Africa and the Middle East, is labor migration. Indonesians working in the Middle East.
I want specifically Africa, south of the Sahara. Thank you.
Nope, sorry. There's not a great deal of contact.
Oh, that was concise. There's not a great deal of contact investment,
no.
South Sahara?
No. But from Southeast Asia, no.
Oh, that was concise. Was that your only question, ma'am?
Yes, thank you.
For sure. Concise one. Caller who dialed in, last four digits, 4443. Did you have a question for Professor McCoy?
Yeah, I had two questions. I guess I was a little bit confused because I guess I just graduated from college recently, and I've noticed a lot of Asian people, like Chinese specifically, and also I've noticed, like just around where I live and when I travel, I see a lot of like Asian females, like Chinese females, in relationships with like white males. And then you also just said that like diversity, you use the term diversity is good for this U.S. empire. But then at the same time, you said that China is on the rise. So I'm sort of trying to couple the two, because it seems like the U.S. is, I don't want to say importing, but there's a lot of Chinese people. I see them getting education. There's, like, the campuses are full of them. And I see a lot of, like, white males marrying and in relationships with Asian women. So I just wanted to know where those two meet or how do those two meet?
Sure. First of all, China has a policy of sending students overseas. And faculty members as well. Every day I get one or two emails from graduate students or professors in China saying they have a scholarship or fellowship and they want to come and work with me, study with me at University of Wisconsin. I have Chinese undergraduates in my classes. I have Chinese graduate students in my programs as well. That's true right across the board in every single discipline and in every major research university in the United States. And this is, I think, you know, very similar to what happened in the 19th and early 20th century, when the United States was on the ascent, we had need for education far in advance of our educational institutions, so that in the latter part of the 19th century, most American doctorates were issued in Germany. And Americans also went to British universities. And this was part of a knowledge and technology transfer from Europe to the United States, which was essential to the rise of the United States as a major industrial commercial power. And China's doing the same thing. They're sending their people here to gain the skills, the knowledge, the insights, and information they need to facilitate their rise. These students are very hardworking. They're very talented. A lot of faculty have collaborative research agreements. American universities have overseas training programs. Although this is a competition and at times a confrontation between China and the United States, it's also similar to what happened between Britain and the United States, from the 1880s through the 1950s. That was a peaceable transfer of imperial power. We may be witnessing the same, although there appear to be many more tensions between China and the United States than there were between Britain and the United States. So it's all part of the process of imperial transition.
Did that answer?
Okay, thanks. Sort of, but I don't want to, I guess, take up the time. My second question was about Southeast Asia, and I've noticed a lot of black people vacationing in Southeast Asia and Thailand a lot, and I had an associate went to Laos, and this associate said that they hated Laos, that it was terrible, but they really liked Thailand. I didn't know that Laos was bombed like that. But another thing that they noticed was that there was a sort of an affinity for whiteness among the people in Thailand and Laos, and that there was a lot of marketing for bleaching products and whatnot. And I was wondering, with your knowledge of Southeast Asia, do you know how this came about and why this still exists right now?
How it came about, no, because Thailand, for example, the logical thing to do would be to attribute it to colonialism. The Filipinos, when they have the same affinity for somewhat lighter skin, although it's not absolute, they call that colonial mentality because they were colonized by Spain and the United States for 350 years, the United States 50 years. But Thailand was never colonized, and so that explanation doesn't hold. Yet it's true that there is an affinity for this lighter skin. Where it comes from in Thai case, I do not know, but it's marked. Sometimes African Americans find living and moving in Southeast Asia permanently, apart from vacation, to be somewhat difficult. I have a few African American friends in the Philippines, and they find it very, very difficult to deal with the society on the whole. They find that they confront racial prejudice on a daily basis, and so that color preference manifests itself evidently in daily interactions.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Actually, years ago, the first African-American ambassador to the Philippines, I think his name was Harry Thomas, appointed by Obama. I was invited to Washington to do a briefing for Ambassador Thomas. And he worked with an African-American scholar on Asian attitudes towards African-American. I think her name was Hazel McPherson. Anyway, we had a formal briefing that Ambassador Thomas wanted in order to engage this issue head on. So he knew how to deal with it personally and how to handle it. And by all accounts, he had quite a successful tenure in the Philippines. So although it's an issue, it didn't block a senior African-American diplomat from doing his job. Gus?
Thank you.
Yes, sir. The caller who dialed in, this is Emmy. Emmy, if you had a question for Professor McCourt, you should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. I'm intrigued by what you've just said, that it's going to be a peaceful transfer of power, similar to what was witnessed between, or what occurred between the United States and Great Britain at the time. And part of me has been really curious that perhaps, and I'm curious, if, my question is, what are your thoughts about what I'm about to say? Could it possibly be that in part it is peaceful because the dynamic that is occurring between the so-called Asian and the Black people is in some ways similar to the dynamic between Black people and white people? And then I guess a similar question in the same vein is, should the United States lose its imperialistic power to the Chinese, to China? What do you foretell that would mean for the American so-called Black person? Are my questions clear?
Yeah, sure. I don't quite get the first one, but I do understand the second one. Can I address that first? And then we can come back to the first one and you could clarify what you mean. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yes, it is. Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Oh, sure. First of all, the impact that the loss of U.S. global hegemony is going to have upon the quality of life in the United States is something we can only speculate about. But I think it's going to be profound. One of the first manifestations of it, I think, will be the weakening of the dollar as a global reserve currency. Right now, the United States is a beneficiary of what I call the grand imperial bargain. We get to send the world brightly colored pieces of paper called U.S. Treasury notes, and they send us automobiles and steel and minerals and oil, you know, real products, and we send them trillions of dollars of our brightly colored paper. And we're able to do that because the dollar status is global reserve currency. Well, already, China's currency, renminbi, has been just 2 years ago incorporated by the International Monetary Fund into the basket of global reserve currencies. And as China's economic power grows and the U.S. position becomes more problematic, our deficit grows, etc., we're likely to fade. That'll mean that very likely part of the structure of life that allows poor and lower middle class Americans to get by, cheap goods. The one thing about America is that we have, I think, the cheapest goods in the world. We pay less for gasoline, other than in major oil producers, for food, for clothes, for disposables than anybody else. And those goods and services are likely to go up in price as the U.S. global economic position worsens. And that is going to put economic pressure upon the poor and the lower middle class in the United States. And so a difficult situation is likely to become, I think, even more difficult. Now, could you explain your first question, please?
Yes, I can. And thank you, because that's not really what I meant for my second one, but I think that's...
Go ahead. Well, I can try again if you want.
No.
You said,
no,
how are you going to impact upon African Americans are are disproportionate to population, are of poor or lower middle class background. So mm-hmm. being further down on the socioeconomic scale, they're going to get hit hard. One of the few breaks that people that don't have a lot of money have in the United States is that food, clothes, and disposable goods, gasoline, motor vehicles, all of these things are relatively cheap on a global scale, and this is likely to stop. And that means that a difficult lifestyle will become even more so.
Mm-hmm. Okay? I can see that. My first question is, there's two options or possible scenarios with the transfer of power, right? You can have a peaceful one, you can have a non-peaceful one. Now, it seems that this one, as you've stated, will be peaceful. Now, in order for it to be peaceful, it must mean that China or whoever this other person or entity is going to keep some things the same, right? Because if I was going to come in and just take over everything and change everything, I think that would lead more to a non-peaceful one. But if I'm going to keep some things the same, we're going to be okay. Like, okay, I might go ahead and let it go. I'm declining, whatnot. Okay, cool. I'm curious to know, is it possible that part of the reason that this is peaceful is that because China, or maybe what people call Asians in general, have the same disregard towards non-white, specifically Black people, that white people do, which would mean that if China becomes a global power, they're not going to change the dynamic, the power relationship that whites have, the dominion that whites have over Blacks. I'm just using these words just to make it clear. Because if China said, well, look, we're going to change all of that. We're going to go ahead and help the Black people, elevate the Black people 500 years. They were oppressed by whites. We're going to change that whole dynamic. I doubt it would be peaceful. But it appears with the way that the Chinese people have already, the little bit that I do know, I understand their dynamic is not one that's necessarily uplifting. Although they might throw some concessions, it generally is a similar dynamic that white people have with Black people. Am I making sense with what I'm asking?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. We began when Gus asked me about the world island, China's world island strategy. Let's go back to that because that really cuts right to your concern. When you say Black people, I think you're probably referring primarily not to African Americans, but to Africa, okay? And so Sir Halford Mackinder, when he propounded the World Islands thesis back in 1904, he was a geographer, and he looked at the map, and he said that Europe, Asia, and Africa are not three separate continents. When you tilt the globe a certain way, they look like a single unified landmass. And so the world island that Mackinder envisioned was three continents, although he never talked about Africa very much, because at that time, Africa, of course, was thoroughly colonized, carved up, and dominated by the Europeans. But China, which seems to be realizing Sir Halford Mackinder's vision of unifying Eurasia via technology, is also using a portion of its $4 trillion in hard currency reserves in order to incorporate Africa thoroughly into the world island. China appears to be spending something like $1 trillion to lay down that infrastructure of oil pipelines and roads and rails across Eurasia. But China plans by 2025 to invest $1 trillion in Africa. China is already the major trade partner for most African nations. China's trade is three times that of the United States. That's why in 2015, President Obama, who I regard as a geopolitical genius, had a strategy for checking China's rise. And part of that strategy was, first of all, his state visits to Africa, and second of all, a head of state's conference for African heads of states that he convened in the White House. And he tried to foster trade, steer U.S. development money to Africa in competition with China, because Obama was very well aware that China's strategy in terms of trade, raw materials, and the like, involved integrating Africa into a Chinese-dominated world island. So, whether or not the transition between the U.S. and China is going to be peaceful or not, Africa is at the heart of China's strategy. It's really $1 trillion for Asian infrastructure and $1 trillion for Africa trade. That's the heart of China's plan for economic global dominion. And that's going to change things, because much of Africa has been starved of infrastructure and capital. And China, although the terms of trade are questionable, a lot of people say that they're terribly unequal. Nonetheless, China's coming into areas and putting in cell phone towers, building subways, developing raw materials. They're developing Africa. Africa has got, some parts of Africa have economic growth because of Chinese capital. So that's a very distinct part of China's global strategy.
Did that answer your question, Amy?
In part, it gave me some more to think about, which I'm grateful for. But I just want to, just a very clear kind of to the point kind of thing. Do you think in part, because I understand everything that you said, but I do think, and I guess I'll just say it, maybe that's better, and then, I'll leave it there, that I do think that part of the reason, because even though China may be investing all this money in African infrastructure, they're also taking a lot out. They're getting considerably, arguably more than they're putting in by utilizing these unused pieces. And I'm using that just like I'm saying that intentionally, that the dynamic is still the same. It's using non-white, using Black people specifically as pieces to gain or maneuver power. I saw that, with European domination and imperialism, colonialism, and that is what I'm seeing now. And I just think at this moment that, and part of the reason that it's okay that maybe the United States isn't having so much of an issue, because it's not uniting with Black people, it's using Black people. And that dynamic is okay. That maintains a subservient position, that maintains a dominance, so that the Asian and the white people will, act as though they are, kind of together because they have a similar group of people that they abuse. Do you think that that's accurate? And that'll be my final question. I appreciate your thoughts.
There have been conflicts between Chinese managers of firms and local African populations. But on the whole, what seems to be striking, and again, the evidence we have is anecdotal, is that wherever the Chinese are turning up, whether it's in the Port of Piraeus in Athens, or whether it's in Iran, or whether it's in Africa, they find people who have the capacity to get outside their cultural skins, learn languages, and interact with local populations, whether it's in Farsi, Greek, or West African languages, form local ties, develop a liking for local culture, assimilate to a certain extent. And that's, for any empire to operate in far-flung locales, far away from the metropole for any period of time, it's got to develop that kind of capacity. That's essential, if you will, to mediating the tensions that come from what is inherently an asymmetric, unbalanced relationship. Yes, China's got the market, China's got the capital, China's got the technology. They can set the terms of trade, and those terms of trade, of course, advantage China and, of course, exploit the local population. But as one very clever political economist said once, I can't remember who it was, but I'll remember it in a while, the only thing worse than being exploited is not being exploited at all. And that's the situation that many underdeveloped areas of the world face. They face it under the United States in our period, and they're now facing it when they deal with China again. And so, yes, it is an unequal and it is an exploitative relationship, but it does represent jobs, development, employment in some form. Complex trade-offs.
Appreciate that, Emmy. M. Handisi, did you have a question for Professor McCoy? You should be with us, sir.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. And my question to you is that I believe you said that in certain parts of the world, it would get too hot for people to survive. Did I hear you correctly?
Too hot for people to conduct herding or agricultural labor. Degrees that will be, temperatures will be 120, 130 degrees for sustained periods of time. So, yes, basically too hard.
Oh, supposed to happen?
Go ahead.
Are you saying that is going to happen, or that we're preventing that from happening, or that was there like a timetable for that? What's going on with that? Is there a timetable for that happening?
It's global warming. It's the trajectory on the likely increase in of average world temperature for the rest of the century. One of the problems in being precise in the calculations is that it's not a simple even rise in temperature everywhere in the globe, okay? It brings, the global warming is bringing with it, and this is beyond my expertise, but I read reports, erratic weather patterns. I think, what is it now? The last 10 years, we've seen record temperatures in the United States. Australia has had sustained record temperatures. If this keeps going, there's a point at which the human body simply cannot conduct sustained labor in the open air when the temperature gets to a certain point, 120, 130 degrees. And that's what we're facing in parts of the globe. Not just for a day or two or 2 weeks, but months of that sustained temperature, which means that agriculture, first of all, there'll be a high rate of evaporation from any kind of water that's put on the soil. And second of all, people have simply been able to do the physical labor of agriculture during daylight hours, which is when you have to work the fields.
My second question was, are the people, the individuals who classify as white, are they scientifically, biologically classified as albino or albinoid?
This is way beyond my expertise, but white is just a melanin. The recent research has found that all human beings have the same genetic composition, the same genes for skin color. It's an environmental adaptation. People in northern climes are whiter because you need lighter skin to absorb vitamin C from weaker sunlight during the winter. People in warmer climes with strong sunlight over the span of centuries, if not millennia, will privilege the darker gene because that gives you resistance to the sun. It's an environmental adaptation. It's nothing inherent.
So you're saying that it's not albinism, because albinism is an inherent genetic condition. So is the white skin, it being a lack of pigmentation, is that albinism scientifically?
No, I don't think so. I'm sure you've met a few. I've met a few people that have albinism, and it's clearly very, very different from just ordinary light skin. It means generally weak eyesight. And not just the skin color.
I think that would be albinoid then, when it's not the most albinized, then I think we would call it albinoid, I think. But then my last question was, the people who classify as white, how long will they remain on the planet as white people, as people without color?
Oh. Well, it's the level, it's not the temperature, but it's the amount of sunlight, and that doesn't change. That's not going to change, I don't think. I think it's basically temperature change, okay? We've the loss of the ozone layer was because of, what was it, the chemical that was used in an air conditioning, and the International Convention fluorocarbons, CFCs. The International Convention on CFCs is actually working, and we are beginning to control the release of CFCs into the atmosphere. Now, that'll mean that the ozone layer won't suffer the same level of damage, and therefore it's mainly temperature rise rather than increasing sunlight that we're going to be faced with. And so, I mean, in that case, it's the skin color will not be a critical factor. You know, I don't.
As far as global warming is concerned, well, but I have heard a lot of I've heard a lot of conversation over the topic of white genetic survival, but more specifically, I've heard white genocide, and a lot of people are talking about that, and that's in the news. I mean, it's well documented, and they say that there is a time period that there will not be people perceptionally white on the planet. And I'm saying, I was asking you, when is that time period that people will not be on the planet perceptionally white or with skin that doesn't have melanin?
Yeah, let me think. I don't know the time period that it took to adapt. Well, let me think. When did people migrate to Europe out of Africa? Do you know that offhand? How many thousand years ago? Was that 40,000 years ago?
I don't have access to that information.
No, I know. No, let's just assume. Okay, let's just assume it's 40,000 years ago. Well, that's how long it took people that had, presumably, and we don't know, but because all we have is bone remains. If we assume that the people that migrated out of Africa had darker skin because they'd adapted, okay, and they moved to Northern Europe from Africa, which is where, as much as our knowledge, we know now that that was the trajectory, then it took them 30 to 40,000 years to basically whiten, to have the lighter genes, the skin color, the genes for lighter skin color slowly supplant the genes for darker skin color in the common pool of genes. So 30 to 4,000 years, okay? So it's a process of change that would take place, assuming that the CFCs problem is not dealt with, that the ozone layer, in fact, erodes, that the sunlight is stronger in northern climes as well as closer to the equator. All of that, it would take thousands of years for that to occur. That would be my guess, but that's just a guess.
Yes, thank you.
Appreciate that, Mhandisi. I think we got all of the folks who dialed in with a question. Hopefully, if you have a question for Professor McCoy, we're about the last 5 minutes, so do not wait. Go ahead and get your hand up immediately. I did want to ask, you posited that with the alleged decline of the U.S. empire and perhaps this conglomerate, the Eurasian mass, and with China developing and their rise, you were saying that hopefully it can be a peaceful transfer of powers, and hopefully the best of American values can be transferred as well. What specifically are the best of American values?
Sure. One of the things that was distinct about the American ascent to global power at the end of World War II was the United States, in cooperation with the victor nations, the Allies at the end of World War II, began to construct an international order, an international community. So they created the United Nations that had far more authority, that was designed to correct all the failings of the preceding attempt, the League of Nations. The United Nations also helped establish the World Health Organization in order to create a global apparatus for the control of epidemic diseases and the promotion of health on a global scale. They also created an international trade order, an attempt to actually create open trade, ending the protectionism that had been so destructive during the 1930s Depression,
that started with the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. Today it's the World Trade Organization. Another hallmark of the best side of America in the international arena was from the time that we began to appear on the world stage, not only the brutal pacification of the Philippines and the penetration of the Caribbean and the constant incursions there. That's the dark side. On the brighter, formal side, from the time that we appeared at the second international peace conference at The Hague, the United States was an advocate for the establishment of the rule of law, that nations would settle their disputes, boundary disputes, all sorts of disputes, through international arbitration by a law rather than by force of arms. Another thing that the United States had, and this was something that we acquired and we introduced basically it was Latin American nations developed this. The U.S. picked this up from Latin American nations, and along with the support of Latin American nations, made this one of the hallmarks of the international order, is that it's the status quo ante, that if there is a conflict between nations, the victor nation may not take territory from the defeated nation, so that wars of territorial conquest were ended. And finally, within the United Nations, the U.S. established something called the Trusteeship Council, and that institutionalized the four freedoms that President Roosevelt had articulated at the start of the war. And it's the idea that basically everybody on the planet has the right to be a member of a sovereign nation, that essentially colonialism is over, that more powerful nations do not have the right to conquer and dominate weaker nations. And so, you know, that broad basket of principles of free trade, the international rule of law, the equality of nations, the community of nations, a world with rising standards of living, free from epidemic diseases, all of this is enshrined in this global community that the United States sponsored. And that's the best side of America's 70 years of global dominion. There are, of course, darker sides as well. And the question is, will that survive? And will that legacy persist? And if we manage this transition well, then there's a possibility that it will. And if not, well, that may not happen.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Professor Alfred W. McCoy. He's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. That reminded me, your last response there reminded me of a different book that we read some years back, Dr. Marimba Ani, her book Yorugu, where she talked about the concept of rhetorical ethic. I think that's something that we mentioned consistently on the broadcast as being a hallmark of the system of white supremacy racism, where things like equality and sovereignty of nations, where these ethics or platitudes are spoken, but they are certainly not something that whites abide by. And I think even your text today, you gave lots of information that during the reign of the U.S. Empire, that was not abided by at all, that whites from the U.S. Empire infringed upon the sovereignty of other nations. You talked about some of that right at the beginning of the program in Southeast Asia and how they undermined their sovereignty, and that they were not about equality amongst nations. They were about spying on and making sure that they had imperial status to dominate global affairs for as long as possible, and looking to extend that now rhetorical ethic, Dr. Marimba Ani's concept. The book we discussed for most of the broadcast, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, just came out this year. You've heard a few snippets from the text. Did I hear you correctly? Did you say earlier that you did talk about the Chicago police in this book?
No, sorry.
Okay.
It's in my work on torture that I referenced that. The model of impunity that I talk about in that essay, and actually I wrote a book called Torture and Impunity in which I use that model. That's grounded on experiences that came in part out of the Chicago police experiment, that the torture, the systematic torture of the Chicago police many of whom actually were Vietnam veterans initially when that process got going back in the 60s and early 1970s. Yeah, I talked about that Chicago experience.
But not in this book, In the Shadows of American Century.
The model of impunity is derivative from that. No, but in my book, Torture and Impunity, 2012, I talked about it. And my book, A Question of Torture, 2006, I talked about it as well.
I see.
Just obliquely. But as I said, Gus, I'm mainly focused on acts of state, okay? Not, when I say acts of state, acts of a federal government, of a national government.
Understood, Professor McCoy. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Sunday evening, even though we didn't get to talk about the book that you wrote before about the heroin trade. Still got great info. I'm sure listeners appreciated hearing from you this evening. Thanks for sharing a bit of your time, and was enjoyable having an exchange with you, sir.
Thank you, Gus. I appreciate the conversation.
For sure, for sure. Evening, sir. Take care.
Evening. Same to you, Gus. Bye-bye now.
Yes, sir. Context of White Supremacy, Alfred W. McCoy. You have to forgive me, the listener who asked specifically to have him on the program. I try to acknowledge where I got the guest recommendation from, but at least we got him on the program. If folks have any comments on what they heard, his concept or theory of the decline of U.S. empire, feel free. If you want to chime in, the number is 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you have commentary. I would just say for myself, I would not confuse, even though it might be correct. I think some of our listeners, they have taken the same opinion that the United States, this area of the world, will be declining in power. In my view, I would not confuse that with an end to the system of white supremacy. I would not conflate the two at all. Things could look different. Things might not be as this area of the world might not be as prominent as the way that things have looked previously. That might not necessarily mean the system of white supremacy has concluded. And even the portion that I read where he's kind of given his prognosis for how things could look if this is the end of what he calls the American empire on 234, where he says, while these elites, doesn't say individuals classified as white, but while these elites take in the view from the 50th floors of their glittering metropoles, the 2 billion poor backed into fetid slums of the global South. Generally, that's a code for black people when they start talking about the global South. Think Brazil, Caribbean, sub-Saharan Africa. Generally, they're talking about a lot of dark people. The Global South by 2030 will, says urbanist Mike Davis, make the feral failed cities of the third world the distinctive battle space of the 21st century. And agreeing with him fully, the U.S. military is already preparing for such a future of endless urban warfare as darkness. There were a lot of references or uses of the term dark and dark times from Mr. McCoy this evening, Professor McCoy. As darkness settles over some future super favela. Favela, I believe, is the term that they use in Brazil for like the ghettos, the slums where they stockpile the dark people down in Brazil. Super favela, the empire can deplore Orwellian technologies of repression while hornet-like helicopter gunships stalk enigmatic enemies in the narrow streets of the slum districts. Every morning, the slums reply with suicide bombers and eloquent explosions. Yet even the dismal vision leaves room for Washington to play a residual role, mediating international conflicts and monitoring the global commons beyond these human cesspits. Page 234 of In the Shadows of the American Century. To me, that does not sound like the end of white supremacy. That just sounds like a really gruesome aspect where you have whites with drones or whatever other types of technologies that they have advanced, where you have lots of black people that are suffering, don't have assets, access to basic human needs, and they just have all this elaborate machinery to, you know, keep them back and fight them off. That's what it sounds like to me. Continued existence of white supremacy, racism, even reminding, correlating nicely with Amy's question, where she asked, you know, what is this going to look like for black, I think she said African-American people in the future. And after some buckets of words and hemming and hawing, he finally got around to saying, yeah, it might be kind of bleak for black people down the road. That response right there and his response about torture, which he felt compelled to come back to towards the end of the broadcast, those I felt were strong indicators. This guy is practicing racism, white supremacy, and in my view, strongly. He can say, I think his defense was that his book was not about domestic acts of terrorism or abuse of black people. He was focused on global acts of imperialism, particularly focused in Southeast Asia. His book, he begins, I think the first 50 pages or so of this book are about him and how he was mistreated in trying to publish his book on the CIA's involvement in the global heroin trade. It wasn't about things happening in Southeast Asia. It was about what was happening to him, difficulties that he faced, his parents' generation growing up in America. It was not, you know, focused outside the U.S. When he began talking about the FBI's counter COINTELPRO tactics in the 1960s and 70s, he was elated to talk about Leroy Burke, the bombing in Wisconsin, to talk about domestic issues that related to his school or just things that he was enthusiastic about. It was only when it was specifically about black people, whether it was Jeffrey Dahmer and his victimization, torture of black people, whether it was John Birch in Chicago, whether it was enslavement of black people, where he got very hesitant to identify, yes, these are acts of terrorism. In fact, he said with Jeffrey Dahmer that he didn't even know enough about Jeffrey Dahmer to identify that as torture or not. That just in my, that is an astronomical, in my view, that is something I astronomically suspect him of practicing white supremacy. I am a non-white person. I'm not super informed. He's written lots of books. He's been writing books for almost 50 years and traveling the world to do research. He's a professor. He said he's been at the University of Wisconsin for years teaching students, graduate students. How can you do all of this writing and reading and research and teaching? And you're telling me that you're not informed about one of the most popular cases to take place in this part of the world in the last 25 years, easily? All of the documentaries and books and all of this on someone who's right in your area, you don't know enough to say, oh yeah, I think that was torture. Okay, the Chicago situation, he seemed reticent with that, and that's especially suspicious if he's saying that, oh yeah, I do know about that, and I've referenced that indirectly in other works, although not this book. That tells me that you do know about this, but you still have some sort of hesitancy about identifying, yes, these are acts of torture, that the American empire, if that's the term that you want to use, torture of black people has been an integral aspect of that since the genesis. Even with slavery, same thing. Hesitance. He eventually, yes, that would be torture, but oh, I just wanted to talk about what happened in Southeast Asia. I just, in my view, whites being hesitant like that, not willing to be truthful, not willing to be honest. Even with Emmy's question, I think she had to come back and redirect. My question was about, what is this U.S. decline? What is that going to be like for African Americans? He gives a general response about how this is going to impact everybody. And then when she says, yeah, I don't really think you answered my question. Oh, yes, yes, yes. You asked specifically about the Negroes. Yeah, it's going to be really bad for you all because, man, you know this. It's not that you're ignorant. It's not that you're poorly informed. You're practicing white supremacy racism and just not answering these questions and not even in your book, not accurately presenting information. That was why I asked him that question at the end, because he gave a talk where he says he hopes if this decline happens and there's a transfer of power, the best of American values can be transferred. The most central, quote unquote, American value is white supremacy, racism, and torturing black people. It could be nothing else but that. That's why I was waiting to see what he was going to list. I mean, if you're talking about equality, that is laughable to have a white person tell me the best of American values are equality and respecting the sovereignty of others. Wow. I will stop there. I do think his concept in terms of U.S. decline could be accurate. Again, that should not be confused, equated with end of system of white supremacy. Two different things entirely. Folks that dialed in, did y'all have any where I guess I'll start with Roz, if we missed anybody else who did not get to participate at all. Roz, since you didn't get to ask a question, did you have any commentary you wanted to share, sir?
Yes, greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to Emmy, MHDC, everybody. It was a great conversation. I was listening quite intensely because this is a subject that I've discussed on my radio show, and I was just listening to what he was saying. And a lot of what he talked about in regards to Chinese-American relations, we actually dealt with, and he said basically a lot of the exact same things that we talked about as far as Chinese machinations towards global domination. What was interesting is a lot of what you talked about when I heard that he was from Wisconsin, a piece to Rob too, and he had the nerve to say he didn't know enough about his story to state whether or not he was torturing people. It was just refined white supremacy. And a lot of the questions that were asked were questions I probably would have asked, but I just wanted to hear other people ask them. And he was just practicing racism through the whole entire conversation. The way that you had to keep redirecting him back on task and interjecting, all of those things just were indicative of his refined white supremacist behavior. And now that you made it clear he's been writing for over 50 years, then, man, he's extremely refined. I think what he was doing was a white supremacist tactic called compartmentalizing, where he was like, well, I'm speaking about, Southeast Asia, and that's it. He just wants to focus on what he thinks is his area of expertise, where he could probably practice racism most acutely and hopefully less exposed in regards to his behavior. And I think that's why he kept compartmentalizing and focusing on Asia. What was interesting about his comments in Africa, and I was figuring the reason I didn't ask this question, this is a question I was going to ask him, is because I figured he was going to practice racism after listening to how he spoke to and treated everyone else. But I was going to ask him about America's loss of its rare earth mineral sites. The last rare earth mineral site that was owned by an American company has now been commandeered by China. And China started grabbing up these sites across the United States 20 years ago. And the very, very last one, I just read an article on our radio show this past summer about that, the fact that the very last one is now transitioning to Chinese hands, which means that the United States cannot dig in its own soil to get rare earth minerals. Now, rare earth minerals are hard to find minerals that are used in technology, specifically military and computer technology. So anything that has to do with creating war, planes of war, satellites, cell phones, computers, all of this stuff is based on rare earth mineral technology. So America no longer has access to its own, and it's now really, really ratcheting up its behavior on the African continent through AFRICOM and in Nigeria, Mali. And I'm pretty sure it's going to go into the Congo, because Congo is where the lion's share of rare earth minerals are on the African continent. And China's been all over that area, like he was saying, making all kinds of inroads across the continent with different countries. They're going to be building all kinds of railroads going across the continent and all kinds of stuff coming down the road. But ultimately, I was going to ask him, does he think that America's behavior that's ratcheting up on the continent has to do with the fact that legally it cannot tap its own resources on the continent because China has basically checkmated them here? But I figured he would have practiced racism, so I just wanted to hear what he had to say to you all. Now, the interesting part about it is I'm from Brooklyn, and an area I grew up in is Fort Greene. Fort Greene was one of the most deadly places to be in Brooklyn during the crack era when I was growing up. And when I've gone there in recent years, it has been flooded with white people and Chinese people specifically. And China's been getting a lot of grabbing up a lot of prime real estate here because America's in receivership for all of the money that it owes, over $20 trillion in debt that it's in. A lot of lion's share of that is owed to China. So basically, China's being allowed to buy up areas here They're sending a lot of their people here as far as just to live here and, of course, get educated here. So when he was talking about American values being exported to China, you hit it right on the head for me, white supremacy. And I've always talked about the fact that we have to watch the relationship of other non-white groups with black people globally, because even though Chinese people are not at they're not the supremacists, they're not at the top, but the bottom line is they've been learning all of the different behaviors that white supremacists practice against darker skinned people, specifically black people. And if we've looked at the history of Chinese black relations, they have not been good, you know? So the idea of China taking over in any way, shape, or form, like you said, has nothing to do with the ending of white supremacy. To me, it just has to do with white supremacists grooming Chinese people to practice racism the way that they're familiar with it, which will, of course, allow Chinese people to say, sure, you know, white people can keep doing what you're doing to the black people. We're going to jump in. Actually, we're going to join in with you now, so that it is a nonviolent transition in regards to the reins of power economically and politically shifting from the United States to China. So everything that you guys elucidated on tonight's program was absolutely just perfect, and it fell right in line with a lot of what I've been studying for the last few years up to today. And he confirmed a lot of it. And even through him practicing racism, I was able to pick up on those nuances, exactly what you were talking about. So I'm going to mute myself and let other people speak. I might chime in later, you know, as people are discussing the things that they wanted to talk about further. But great, great program. I'd expected nothing less from you, Gus, and I look forward to it. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. The other folks who dialed in, I'm trying to make sure if we didn't miss anybody who didn't get a chance to speak at all or ask a question at all. I think everybody else who's here got to participate. The other folks who dialed in, if you had a hand up, if you had a commentary you wanted to share, feel free. I'm sorry?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you, Rob.
Can I be heard? Hello?
We can hear you, Rob, in Wisconsin.
Can I be heard?
Okay. How about this? Yeah. I'm going to mute your line, and then I'll unmute. We can hear you, Rob, in Wisconsin. We can hear you. I'm not sure if you're what's wrong with your audio. I'll unmute your line again and see if that works. Okay. Are you with us, Rob, in Wisconsin? Not hearing you at all. Rob in Wisconsin, are you with us, sir?
Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Can you hear us?
Yes, I'm speaking. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hold on. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Rob.
Yes, I can hear you. All right. In the words of Neely Fuller, word masters, you cannot be a person. Am I being heard?
Yes.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you, Rob. We can hear you.
What's going on? Am I being heard right now?
Seems like there's some interference on the line.
Okay. Because you can't be in Wisconsin and not be informed about Jeffrey Dahmer. I thought that. Hello? Hello?
We can hear you. I think there's a delay.
Okay. You can't be in Wisconsin and not be informed about Jeffrey Dahmer. Was that heard clearly?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then for him to be writing books about the opioids, I mean, going way in depth with the opioid epidemic, all the way in Southeast Asia, and not be informed about the opioid epidemic that's going on in Milwaukee. I thought that he was clearly practicing deception. And just in the words of Neely Fuller, word masters. Thank you.
Indeed. Appreciate that, Rob, in Wisconsin. Glad we got through the tech issues. Yeah, I just find that hard to believe. I mean, if it was a non-white person, maybe, but a white professor, and he's not just a professor, he's a chair of the history department at the University of Wisconsin. And you're in the very state where this happened. I just have a very hard time believing that you don't know enough details. I'm not saying that you have to know every tidbit about the case, the exact year that he was arrested and the exact year that he was convicted. But I think you would know enough surface details to be able to answer immediately in the affirmative. Oh, yeah, he tortured those victims, mostly black victims. Oh, yeah, he tortured them. Next question. Like, that's just absurd for him to have that much trouble. In fact, to say that he was ignorant enough that he couldn't even answer the question. Did anybody else have commentary they wanted to share?
Hey, Gus, you know, related to what you just said, it made me think. I was listening to a show with Melanated Roots on Black Talk Radio Network a few weeks ago, and they were talking about the use of mythology and how white people create narratives, and the fact that and this speaks right to what you just said about the guest, the fact that white people will never allow a narrative of terror or torture to be built around white people, which is why you never see when they commit acts of terror and acts of torture, it's not described properly. But yet, if they describe anything that a black person does, can easily be called terrorism in this country, because the narrative and the mythology of what a terrorist is built around black people and other non-white people. So what it was to me was just that he was not going to break the narrative. The narrative is that black people are black identity extremists. We're an insurgent population. And as a result, that label can never be placed on white people, especially by another white person, because like you said, it would bring truth in a way that white people would never want to be exposed, because rhetorical ethics, deception, Machiavellianism, that is what they do. That is in their DNA. And to me, he did what white people do. And that's one of the reasons why I felt that he is probably one of the most refined white supremacists you've had on the show in a while, simply because just what Rob said, how could you be from Wisconsin? And he said he knew that he had body parts in the fridge. So you mean to tell me you didn't read anything about torture before you got to the body parts? Because in all the articles and the books that I read, they discussed what he did to them as far as torturing them before choking them to death, beating them to death with hammers and whatever other stuff he was doing before chopping them up into body parts to put in his fridge. So he's full of crap. And that whole approach is just his way of being extra, extra refined. And it was just, to me, it was a treatise. This show is a treatise on watching the wisdom of psychopaths, the machinations of the white mind, and how it deflects, it compartmentalizes, and it has like an immune system as far as the way that it functions in elucidating truth about white supremacy. White people have an immune system that fights that at all costs, and it comes out in the way that they speak. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
For sure. Any of the other folks that dialed in who did get to ask a question, do y'all have any final comments or closing thoughts on what you heard from Professor McCoy?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. When I read the summary of what the show is going to be about and whatnot, I remembered. And sort of when I was listening to him, especially when you asked him about like what he went through, I guess, due to CIA tactics against him, whatever, I was thinking about like Yorubu in terms of like the lonely man. Like he I mean, it was a lie. It was like bloated, but what you were talking about with him, like the beginning of his book where he's just talking about himself. I really thought about Yorubu a lot the whole time when he was talking, with the universalism, like the terms like international community and whatnot. So he was really, really refined. The reason why I asked the question about like, I guess importation, if that's the importation of Asians to the US, and also like in Asia, how they have like a really, really strong affinity for light skin, especially the females. I 100% back what you're saying. Like, even if there's some sort of, I don't know, shift of power, monetary stuff and whatnot, I still think that white supremacy is going to be the rule, because these people are getting married. I see them all over. All over, they get married. My family's from so-called Africa, some part of so-called Africa, and they mistreat the black people there a lot. These Asians, I mean, the Chinese, Taiwanese, Singaporeans, like wherever they over there, they mistreat people. So I think the same thing is just going to continue. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Very important distinction. I thought even his answer at the beginning when I asked him about the system of white supremacy, and it took about 5 minutes for him to finally say, no, I don't think such a system exists now, which is fine. Just, you know, answer the question. What's the problem with that? Also, I wanted to get in as well. I thought Raza's commentary about the narrative, being unwilling to provide a narrative where white people are terrorists. It's supposed to be black people. They're the terrorists. We're the thugs. We're the boogie monsters. With Professor McCoy, I thought it was interesting. He didn't seem to a degree, he didn't seem indicting white terrorism with regards to Asian people and what, you know, was happening with the drug trade and other things that they were doing in that part of the world. He talked about the bombing campaign in Laos as well. He seemed to have a real reticence and unwillingness to indict white terrorism against black people specifically. It seemed like he said he had no pride. I think he said at the very beginning, he felt U.S. empire. You can most acutely see how that power is exercised in Southeast Asia, and then was content to rattle off all these different examples over decades of abuse in that part of the world. But total unwillingness to talk about, highlight, acknowledge torture, terrorism against black people in this part of the world. Even his response when I brought up lynching. And I said that right there would be another example of torture against black people. And it seemed like there was some hemming and hawing before yes, and then trying to pivot from that to just say, well, I'm just talking about state violence and state violence on a global level in Southeast Asia specifically. Nothing as it relates to black people. Any other folks that we didn't that asked a question, but if you had any closing thoughts that you wanted to get in? Any other folks? Did you have commentary? Other folks all satisfied? We didn't miss anybody? Nobody that we missed completely at hand a hand up? Grand. Assume we nabbed everyone. Did think constructive information. I would have been happier talking about his earlier book on the heroin trade. But as I said, he didn't want to talk about that. I think I was explaining to a listener a lot of times with the whole book publishing business. I'm trying to make money. That's a key aspect of writing all these books and publishing and making money. I've done all the interviews that I'm going to do about that other book, on to new topics, trying to make more money and push other ideas. Done enough interviews and talking about the whole heroin trade. I also thought that reminded me of Wisdom of Psychopath and specifically the narcissism aspect, specifically the talking about, for people who haven't read this book, In the Shadows of the American Century, literally like the first 50, I could be more precise looking at the numbers here, but I think like the first 50 pages or so is focused on him talking about like his childhood, his family, his dad's alcoholism, people he grew up with in the neighborhood, what they did in their careers, what he did with his career, him fighting against the Vietnam War, how he got into all this. Like it's him before he gets to global empire. It's him and suppression with his first book and other things that he did specifically in his life. When I asked him, when he talked about he was harassed from that first book and I asked for details, I thought he was, man, the violin almost began to play when he was talking about he had like a poverty wage and they audited him and all the other things that he experienced. That's why I had to interject. this guy is the chair at a major university in Wisconsin. Do not be fooled by the, whoa, woe is me, the boogeyman CIA people came to get me and messed over my life. Whoa, whoa. This guy is the chair at a major university. He has not done that bad. And you will see that pattern consistently where white people, even if they're going out, we had Bill Ayers on the program. He's a distinguished professor in Illinois. He was going out and blowing up buildings during the 1960s and 70s, wanted by the FBI and everything. Things turned out okay. Very different equation with regards to whites. And if they encounter any bumps in the road, any sort of mistreatment for a brief period of time, they tend to do okay. Very different from black people. I just caution folks, anytime it seems like whites are trying to get you to lean into, oh man, I was so harassed. I had it so bad trying to get this published. They were tapping my phones and oh, had to, only by the grace of God that I'm still here. Be real careful because they will do that sort of narrative on a regular basis. And in fact, I think in Wisdom of Psychopaths, Kevin Dutton talked about that is one of the traits of psychopathy, playing the victim role. It's not just that you go out and abuse and take advantage of other people. You always come back around to, wait a minute, I'm the one that's being mistreated. They, you know, have gotten over on me. Somebody has wronged me. That tends to be a part of the psychopathy. In my view, that tends to be a part of the operations of white supremacy racism. Folks, satisfied? Any final comment?
Yeah, I had a comment because you just said something really brilliant. Yes, I find that when white people can use things that more powerful white people do to them in order to play the victim role around other actual victims of white supremacy, especially us, like you said, the violins start playing. They're going to tell you their whole life story. And, you know, my life is similar to Dr. King's. Look at what they did to me. And the crazy part is we, in this part of the world, come from a culture where the outlaw is revered. So you have the actual culture that says to be an outlaw, especially white people, to be an outlaw and against the government and, you know, to fight them is a wonderful thing and you should stand on that. And yet when it's convenient for them, they'll want to play the victim in order to practice more refined white supremacy on their victims. And that is something that I pay attention to. I'm glad that you brought that up because it's something that they use all the time in order to get us for us to feel some sort of sympathy and empathy for them when they have no sympathy or empathy for us. And that is something we have to pay acute attention to because the psychological warfare is real, and that is one of the major ways that they facilitate that. Thank you.
Indeed. Indeed. With that, if folks want to check out the text, feel free. I actually did look, make sure I could be precise. It's about the first 24 pages of the text. In fact, it's titled, that chapter, U.S. Global Power and Me. Real specific for the beginning of the text. But yeah, that's the first 24 pages of In the Shadows of American Century. If you want to check it out, definitely not on Gus T. Renegade's top 10 list, although it might be of some value to, you know, folks who, like I said, some people, they do take that perspective that that's what's happening in the United States and that really the election of President Obama signaled the decline, having a Negro in the White House, and things have supposed to been going downhill since then. Also wanted to make sure that I let people know the iTunes feed. There's still problems that are beyond Gus T. This is not my incompetence or laziness or anything else. There's a site problem that is impacting several other podcasts and just being able to upload the content to iTunes. Hopefully that will be corrected soon. You can continue... If you want to send an email, any platform, regardless if it's iTunes or anywhere else, SoundCloud, Blueberry, anywhere where you listen to the program, if you have any problems accessing the content, I would definitely encourage sending an email. Let them know that you listen to the content on their platform. You patronize them. You bring traffic to the website. You share links so that other people can come and listen at that site. And you would appreciate any assistance in making sure that the stream is restored. Any site where you access the cows, the archives, even though they might not be on iTunes, like for this broadcast or the ones that we've had the last three or four, might not be on the iTunes feed immediately. They are available at Black Talk Radio Network and immediately, like within a few minutes of the program ending, the broadcast will be archived at Black Talk Radio Network. It'll be at SoundCloud. Mr. Fox will probably have it uploaded to YouTube without much delay. It'll be available on a number of different platforms, and I generally have the archives posted on Twitter, Facebook. You should be able to easily find them. If you have any difficulties, you can drop an email about that as well. But hopefully this problem will be corrected soon. Could be racist interference, but it does seem to be a site-wide thing. It does seem to be impacting more broadcasters than just Gus T. So we'll see how it proceeds. With that, thanks for the folks who dialed in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Sunday evening. Reading is more important than watching television. Even if you don't want to read Mr. McCoy's work, he does have some constructive works. This one was not my favorite, but even if you don't want to read that biography on Jeffrey Dahmer, that's something constructive to read about. The history of torture in the United States, constructive to read about. The history of Chicago torturing black people in Chicago, lots of information available to read. What China's doing in Africa. Reading is more important than watching television. We have a lot of problems. Let's be as constructive as possible with our time and energy. And make sure I congratulate Emmy. She's doing hard work educating young minds, trying to make sure we get our next generation of mathematicians and scientists, and been reaping great rewards, molding young black scholars. Great work. Keep up the outstanding effort. We need brilliant young black people, unless we're just going to be continued to subjected to the Alfred W. McCoys of the world. We should be here on Tuesday. We will have the director of the AFIA Center. It's an organization in Texas where they do great work for black mothers, expecting black mothers, and making sure that they have resources to have healthy pregnancies, to produce healthy black children. That should be Tuesday, December 5 at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Folks who are asking about lactation counseling, doulas, other informations for expecting parents or new parents, perhaps, feel free to chime in and ask questions. Take advantage of the broadcast this coming Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. With that, we will wrap things up. I will again encourage sobriety. There are a lot of problems that we are facing right now. War, terrorism is being waged against black people. I think it would behoove us to be able to think clearly, to produce solutions, new concepts, new strategies to neutralize racist man, racist woman, racist child. I think there's a lot of evidence. He was just talking about the global heroin trade. A lot of evidence that whites, they have put huge amounts of time and energy in trafficking, selling, peddling narcotics, drugs, poisons, so that they can compromise our mental health, our spiritual health, our will and focus to replace white supremacy with justice. I am certain Dr. Marimba Ani, Minister Malcolm X, Dr. Kambon, many of the folks that we revere and say they meant a lot to us, Dick Gregory, I am sure would say, hey, I think we would be in a better position being sober, especially if you're going to be out and about in a vehicle. Definitely want to be sober and buckled up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.